KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. We present talks by writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. This week, in the aftermath of our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, questions remain concerning how we waged those wars. Among them, did we follow the Geneva Conventions, or did we abuse the rights of our enemies? This past April, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence voted to declassify and make public the findings of its report on the CIA's detention and interrogation program. The documents have been sent to President Obama and the CIA for declassification. They are expected to be made public in some form this summer. In a recent Seattle event titled Exposing the Truth of U.S. Torture, a panel examined questions of our rights and obligations in wartime. The keynote speaker was Brigadier General David Irvine, an Army Reserve Strategic Intelligence Officer who taught prisoner interrogation and military law for 18 years. This first segment begins with comments from UW Professor Rob Crawford, followed by Congressman Jim McDermott, and then General Irvine. This event took place at Seattle's University Temple United Methodist Church on June 3rd, 2014.
President Obama, in 2009, talking about U.S. torture, said something that's become very well known in the anti-torture movement and beyond. He said, in regard to torture, that we need to look forward, not backward. Well, the premise of this event tonight is just the opposite of that, we need to look backward if we are to move forward towards a progressive realization of our deepest held values for our country. Milan Kundera said that the struggle of men and women against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. If our government has committed an injustice, the people need to know about it. How else do we confront the past? How else do we discern what should be done to prevent present and future injustices? So the underlying message of tonight's program is the travesty of U.S. torture, authorized, I remind you, at the highest levels of the U.S. government, is not behind us.
Well, General Irvine, welcome to Seattle.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. I can only stay a few minutes, but I wanted to add my voice to what you're doing here tonight. I was going to start with a story. I offered the amendment in the House to the Intelligence Authorization Bill that would codify what the president had put in his executive order. Politically, an atomic bomb went off in the House of Representatives, and suddenly it was pulled from the bill and never was ever voted on. It created so much consternation that members didn't want to have the opportunity to vote for or against it. The issue that has always troubled me most about the whole question of torture, and it's very idiosyncratic in some senses because I am a physician and a psychiatrist, and very often physicians and psychiatrists are intimately involved in the decisions made about what is torture and what is not. When is waterboarding too much? When is it not enough? All these questions in which mental health professionals and other physicians get involved, in my view, is against our oath as a physician. That is to protect life and to take care of people and not to torture them. We vilified a number of Nazis, Mengele and others who were accused of using their medical profession as torture. And certainly, we don't want to think of ourselves in those lights, but in fact, when we participate in one of those events, we're doing that. I come from a tradition, I'm Irish, there is an old tradition in Breton law that goes back to the ancient Gaels, that when your enemy has put you in a position where you have nothing left you can do, what you do is you go to his front doorstep and lie down on the front steps and starve yourself to death, so that your enemy has to come out every day and step over your body and go about his or her business and come back at night and step over that body, and you continue that until you die. You saw this in action in Longkench Prison in Northern Ireland, where Bobby Sands and 10 other Irishmen starved themselves to death. We have that situation going on today in Guantanamo. And rather than let them starve themselves to death, we are force-feeding them, using doctors and the medical profession as a means of keeping them alive. Somehow that's humane. I mean, we've tortured them for 12 years in a place with no hope of ever seeing a judge, never getting out, nothing. And when they decide they've had enough and they're going, we then are going to save them for more of it. Think about that when you think about what torture really is. And I think that this issue is continuing to ferment in our society. The reason Gitmo is such a very difficult vote in the House of Representatives is because everybody who really thinks about it knows there are 50 or 60 people that we've said are no problem, but we won't let them go. We keep them. And you have to ask yourself, who are we? Because we're the ones that are allowing that to happen. And that's why these kind of events, in my view, are very, very important, because they continue to raise the awareness in the society of the fact that our government, on behalf of us, does things for which we ourselves would never agree. And we have to make our voices heard. And so I'm pleased that you're having this meeting tonight. And I'm sorry I can't stay and hear the bulk of the discussion. I know of the general's work, and I'm pleased by it. And I think that it's important that people be willing to speak up. So thank you all for coming.
I'm David Irvine. I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. I appreciate very much having had a chance to listen to Congressman McDermott and appreciate so greatly his commitment to doing the right thing in this very difficult situation. Let me just say preliminarily that I'm a lawyer. I practice in Salt Lake City. I spent 18 years as an Army intelligence officer, holding down an assignment with the Army Intelligence School, teaching prisoner of war interrogation and military law over a fairly long period of time to a fairly large number of soldiers, Marines, and airmen. And I think that's why I was invited to participate in this task force, as well because I have been part of a group of some 50 to 60 retired admirals and generals who have been very active since 2005 in trying to make the case that as a nation we are safer if we respect the Geneva Conventions and if we hold prisoners who are in our custody in accordance with the standards that Geneva requires. We have been unhappy and working hard to try to get the United States out of the torture business. We have tried and still try to get the prison at Guantanamo closed and to either try those who are held there or release them. We believe strongly that indefinite imprisonment without charges and without a trial is absolutely contrary to the values of the United States. So the task force that the Constitution Project put together was a bipartisan effort. And let me just introduce the two co-chairs of the project. One was a former member of Congress who is a Republican, Asa Hutchinson, and some of you may remember Congressman Hutchinson from Arkansas as one of the House managers in the Clinton impeachment hearings. The other co-chair, was a former congressman, a Democrat, former Congressman James Jones, who also was, I was interested to learn, Chief of Staff for President Lyndon Johnson. Both of these individuals were diligent, they are distinguished, they are men of integrity, they are men who, while having different political positions on many, many things, found it important to be a participant in this bipartisan effort dealing with this significant subject in our history. We produced this report. It's a 600-page report. It is, in our judgment, the most comprehensive report and look at what the United States did with those in our custody from 2001, how we treated them, how we interrogated them, and very importantly, what we did or did not receive from them by way of strategic information. The task force made 24 separate findings and recommendations, and I should state that 23 of those 24 were unanimous decisions. The events that we examined in this report are truly unprecedented in our history. There have been many wars in which we have been involved. There has never been an instance before where the kinds of detailed discussions took place at the very top echelons of our government, as they took place here, dealing with the wisdom, the propriety, and the legality of deliberately inflicting unspeakably severe pain and anguish mentally on people in our custody. And we proceeded from a belief that having as thorough an examination as possible of what occurred during this period really only strengthens the nation and better equips us to deal with the next crisis when it comes along, as a crisis will surely come along. And if we fail to do that, we risk weakening our ability to claim our place as an exceptional and exemplary practitioner of the rule of law.
Stay tuned for more from the recent Seattle panel exposing the truth of U.S. torture. Coming up, General Ervine outlines the findings of the Bipartisan Task Force on Detainee Treatment. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
919 94.9 KUOW. A mountain rescue worker in County Tipperary, Ireland, talks about a couple recovered from that region's beautiful but potentially treacherous rhododendron forests. That'll be part of As It Happens tonight at 11. KUOW would like to thank the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit kuow.org. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows lower to mid-50s, rain likely. Friday highs mid to upper 60s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers in the morning. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows near 50, mostly cloudy. Saturday, highs near 70 and mostly sunny.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This week's forum features a talk by Brigadier General David Ervine. He taught prisoner interrogation for 18 years and is a member of the Bipartisan Task Force on Detainee Treatment. Ervine was the keynote speaker at this Seattle event titled Exposing the Truth of U.S. Torture. Next up, he details task force findings.
The first unanimous finding that we reached as a task force, and we think this is enormously significant, is that United States forces in many instances and across several theaters of war used interrogation techniques that constitute torture. We debated long and hard about how to use language that would describe what we found and what we observed and what we concluded. We recognized that in any conflict, truth is the first casualty of war. And one of the truths that was a first casualty of this war was the way we used language. And we used it in a couple of significant ways. We changed the terminology for referring to prisoners and started referring to them as detainees. And this was done for a couple of reasons. Number one, if they were prisoners, then maybe they were entitled to certain protections under the Geneva Conventions that for various reasons the government did not wish to observe. But that was an important distinction, and many things flowed from that. I will tell you that the guys at Guantanamo are prisoners. They are not detainees. They are not held there. They have not been there for 10 years because they violated a stop sign and ran a red light. They are there because we have put them there on charges and allegations that they were war criminals, although very few have been charged with anything. And 46 are still there who are slated for indefinite detention for who knows how long. The second unanimous finding that we made was that the nation's most senior officials, through some of their actions and inactions, bear ultimate responsibility for some of the conduct that we found was, in fact, torture. The third significant finding, and this is really important, we believe, is that as far as the public record is concerned, and that was all that we had access to, we had no access to classified information, there is no firm or persuasive evidence that the widespread use of harsh interrogation, I like to call it what it is, brutal interrogation, by U.S. forces produced significant information of value. We found no clear or persuasive evidence in the public record that torture produced more useful information than conventional methods of interrogation or that it saved lives. Let me expand on that for just a second. One of the claims that is made by proponents of enhanced interrogation, that was the second switch in language, it's just not politically correct to say we torture people because we don't torture people. We're Americans. We don't do that. The president, the vice president, spent years telling us we don't torture. We treat people humanely. So we used the term enhanced interrogation to walk around the very strict and pretty specific requirements of federal law and international law that prohibit the kinds of things we intended to do. The reason that we say no connection can be made between enhanced interrogation or torture and useful intelligence is that there's only one instance that we've been able to find in the public record where anyone, and there are various people who have made this claim, but they all cite back to the Library Towers plot. And that was the plot that involved the hijacking of airplanes and flying them into the Library Towers building in Los Angeles. The problem with that claim is that you can't connect the dots in a time sequence between the dates of capture and interrogation and events as they occurred. In many instances, the interrogations that were claimed to have taken place at an earlier point in time did not take place until several months later or weeks later. The timeline that would support a finding that interrogation A led to piece of information B, which led to the arrest of person J, which ultimately led to information contained in P, Q, R, and S that thwarted a plot, cannot be established from the public record. Another significant unanimous finding was that U.S. officials involved with detention at CIA black sites committed acts of torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. The reason I selected this finding was because the kinds of things that we, not you, not me, but were the things that were done in your name and my name, are the same kinds of things that have been denounced by the United States when they have been practiced by other nations. We concluded that lawyers in the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel repeatedly gave erroneous sanction to various activities that amount to torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, and that in doing so, they really failed to properly serve their clients, the President, and the American people. And as an example of what I'm talking about, you probably, if you have followed the topic, are familiar with what have been called the torture memos. And these were the memoranda that were issued by DOJ lawyers to sanction the enhanced interrogation techniques that the White House, the Secretary of Defense, and others were so anxious to implement. We found that in many instances, the lawyers who wrote these memoranda were misled as to the actual effects medically and psychologically of the techniques that they were being asked to approve of, and that the intentional misleading of those who prepared those memos was something that unfortunately led to their easier acceptance as proper and as useful. We found also that medical professionals, as Congressman McDermott described, including physicians and psychologists, were participating in interrogations and in ways that it seemed to us violated the ethical standards that they are expected to adhere to as physicians and psychologists and psychiatrists, and that they were using the medical information they gained from treating these prisoners to allow the interrogating teams to more effectively exploit their medical or psychological weaknesses. One of the curious things about torture is that a majority of Americans today, and a larger majority than in the history of the last 10 years, believe that torture in certain instances is appropriate, that it's necessary, that it's really not torture, and that it has produced extremely valuable intelligence that has saved tens of thousands of lives. And this is the message that is over and over and over and over again emphasized by those who believe that enhanced interrogation ought to be a regular part of American policy in dealing with terrorist threats or other threats. And this claim has largely been unrebutted, because those who make the claim then say, if you only knew what I know, because I was in a position to have access to the classified documents that told me how effective this was and how vital it was that we have the ability to get people who are hardened, who are trained to resist conventional interrogation techniques, to talk, to break, to tell us where the next plot was going to take place. Most Americans, I'll submit to you, have no idea in the world what enhanced interrogation really entails. A lot of people have heard of waterboarding, and the President, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, have emphatically stated that waterboarding is not torture. Well, waterboarding has been held as torture by United States military courts, by international courts. It's the oldest torture of preference from the days of the Spanish Inquisition. So I thought I should just share with you a list of some of the kinds of interrogation techniques that we found through the unclassified public record have been used either by United States personnel directly or by our surrogates since 2001. And these various techniques have been used not only by themselves on a standalone effort, but most frequently they have been used in combination and simultaneously, so that the psychological and medical adverse effects on the persons they were practiced upon have been ratcheted up to the point that we have We have driven more than a few people insane. But I'll just suggest to you that if these kinds of practices were used by another nation on American servicemen who were captives, who were prisoners of war, we, as a nation, would not tolerate it. I became interested in this topic when I saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib, as did many of my colleagues. And I'm sharing with you a statement that former Secretary of State Colin Powell made following Abu Ghraib. I made this statement to foreign government officials in an effort to explain to them why this was an anomaly that should not be considered as representative of America or what we stand for. And I will read this with you. Watch America. Watch how we deal with this. Watch how America will do the right thing. Watch what a nation of values and character, a nation that believes in justice, does to right this kind of wrong. Watch how a nation such as ours will not tolerate such actions. They will see a free press and an independent Congress at work. They will see a Defense Department led by Secretary Rumsfeld that will launch multiple investigations to get to the facts. Above all, they will see a president, our president, President Bush, determined to find out where responsibility and accountability lie, and justice will be done. Well, we've had a lot of investigations. I'm not sure that the statement, justice will be done, was a promise that was ever redeemed, but I'll leave that to your conclusion. The Guantanamo prison facility is the most expensive incarceration facility the government operates. It costs us $2.7 million per prisoner per year to house the remaining prisoners at Guantanamo. And with the release of the last five, that number is going up. The cost per prisoner in the federal system, federal penitentiaries across the country, is anywhere from $34,000 to $78,000 per inmate per year. But let me just call your attention to one of the most ironic aspects of what Guantanamo has become. And this is from Colonel Mo Davis, who was the chief prosecutor for the Guantanamo Military Commission proceedings until he resigned. And the reason he resigned was that he refused to prosecute with evidence that had been obtained under torture. But he made this observation not too long ago. Speaking of the military commission system, it's a very strange system where a guilty plea to a war crime is your ticket home. But if you are never charged with a war crime, you can be imprisoned for life. I'm flipping this up because it's a letter that a number of my colleagues and I sent to members of the Senate last year. And I'll just call your attention, first of all, to that list of retired admirals and generals. And I put that up because I hope you will appreciate that these are not flower children. And they're not advocating that prisoners of war be mollycoddled. They're not proposing that every night before going to bed, every prisoner at Guantanamo be given his choice of strawberry or chocolate ice cream. They're approaching the issue of Guantanamo from the very serious consideration of what makes sense for national security. As retired flag and general officers, we believe it is imperative for Congress to address Guantanamo now. It's a betrayal of American values. The prison is a symbol of torture and justice delayed. In 2005, I had the unique experience of sitting around a very, very large conference table with a group of about 50 of these retired flag officers. And the officer at this end of the table was a retired four-star Marine who had been the Commander-in-Chief of Central Command following the first Gulf War, General Joseph Hoar. The officer at this end of the table was a four-star Army retired General, Jack Vesey, who had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Vesey was one of the most respected Army officers in the history of the service. But as we were all going around this room, and I listened to these guys each make a comment about why they were there, and they all flowed from having seen what I saw and what you saw in the photographs at Abu Ghraib. But finally, General Vesey, who was at this point kind of creaky, was waving an old field manual in his hand, and he said, "All right, I want you guys to pay attention to what I'm going to tell you, because it's really, really important." And he said, "This is the gold standard, and somehow we have allowed ourselves to be led away from the gold standard." And then he quoted from a few paragraphs in that manual, and I was impressed enough with what he said that I've copied that. I've passed this out in I don't know how many places. But this is the key language. U.S. law follows the flag. Murder, rape, torture, theft are all criminal acts. This is the key. Whenever an officer winks at the depredations of his men, it is no different than if he committed the act. When soldiers understand that depredations will not be tolerated, they will comply. And I'll just say very quickly to you that Abu Ghraib was not the work of a few bad apples. It was too many officers, too many non-commissioned officers, not paying attention to what soldiers under their command were doing. And that vital element of command discipline broke down, and they became a mob. This list of claimed advantages to enhanced interrogation is interesting, and I'm not going to read those to you, but I want to call your attention to the line at the very, very bottom. The task force found evidence in the public domain that refuted or cast doubt on every one of those claims. For example, when the White House proposed adopting enhanced interrogation standards that clearly violate the Geneva Conventions, all of the judge advocates general, the judge advocate generals, didn't say that right, of each of the services wrote memoranda to the Secretary of Defense advising him that if he proceeded down this path, not only was he risking violating federal and international law, but he was placing American troops in danger if they became prisoners. Those memoranda to the Secretary were classified because the administration did not want them to become public. It was only because Senator Lindsey Graham pitched a fit that they were eventually released. And I'll conclude by just noting that the torture fires have been banked, but they are not extinguished. As long as the proponents of enhanced interrogation, torture, can continue to claim that torture and abuse are critical to protecting the nation against terrorist attacks, while the hard evidence to support those claims remains shrouded in secrecy, there will be a temptation. I'll go even farther. There will be a public demand to do whatever it takes to protect the nation in times of a future crisis. And because we as a nation have been sold this bill of goods, that torture is the key to our security and safety, there will be a demand that it be restored to what some claim ought to be its rightful place as a necessary and valuable tool of conducting American military and foreign policy. And with that, I'm going to close and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
Stay tuned for more from the recent Seattle event exposing the truth of U.S. torture. After the break, a UW professor and a local pastor examine our rights and responsibilities concerning torture. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
940-949-KUOW. We are going to hear the sound of an estimated 100,000 ducks crossing a road in Thailand later tonight. It's part of As It Happens. Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Aquarium, where families can discover the answers to interesting questions about Puget Sound marine life, such as, why do otters hold hands while they sleep? Learn more about the Seattle Aquarium and its commitment to clean, healthy ocean waters at seattleaquarium.org. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows lower to mid-50s, rain likely. Friday, highs mid to upper 60s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers in the morning. Singer-songwriter Sean Sullivan, two-time winner of the John Lennon Songwriting Contest, employs his voice and guitar for an eclectic set of covers and originals, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, this is Speakers Forum. This next segment starts with Professor Beth Riven, a pediatrician and director of the University of Washington's Global Health and Justice Project. She'll be followed by Reverend Rich Lang of Seattle's University Temple United Methodist Church. Then Scott Rehm with Washington, D.C.'s The Constitution Project finishes up the presentations.
Good evening. I'm here to tell you that every single one of you in the audience has a human right not to be tortured. And every single one of the prisoners in all the sites that we just learned about have a right also not to be tortured because they're human, and we have human rights. Now let's think about where human rights comes from. The modern human rights that we talk about, freedom from torture, really comes from the atrocities and the reaction to the atrocities in World War II, right? We know about the Nuremberg trials and indeed the Nuremberg Code, which Congressman McDermott referred to as the standard for ethical behavior for health professionals, also comes from those violations of research ethics, which at that point weren't violations in the concentration camps, but only from those experiences did we have those standards. And we now have human rights standards from World War II and the Nuremberg trials and the trials in the Pacific. We see that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 speaks to freedom from torture. Every individual has the right to be free from torture. We see this again in binding international human rights law. So the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, again, articulates the right for every human being to be free from torture, not to be tortured. These rights are inalienable.
I was asked to be here as the religious voice, and there is a coherency of the religious voice in just about every religion I know, and it's some version of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But there is certainly an incoherence in our actions. And I don't have to look past my own tradition of Christianity and our own involvement in torture to know that. I also know that in a different venue, a Christian pastor could be up here supporting torture. And so I'll just name that I come out of a tradition of Bonhoeffer and Romero and Tutu, and in our own country, Dan and Phil Berrigan, in terms of what stream I swim in as a religious voice. I also want to expand the topic a bit, and I don't mean to go off topic, because I think there's a deeper issue even than the horror of torture. The issue of torture is one part of a much larger picture called the global war on terror. And here's the story. The state is telling us a story. And the story is that we are under attack and need to be afraid. And this story is rooted in 9/11, a day when 19 basically low-life, mostly Saudi Arabians outwitted the multi-layered trillion-dollar defense systems of America. Conveniently, on a day when war exercises were happening that both confused a response and had removed the capacity to respond from the area. These lowlives managed to hijack four planes, crashing two into New York towers, causing three buildings to basically freefall into destruction, crashed a plane into a Pennsylvania field, evaporating it, crashed a fourth into the world's most heavily defended building in the most heavily defended city in the world, again, basically evaporating it. And then in the aftermath, other terrorists managed to leak out an anthrax attack on two Democratic senators just in time to pass an unread but somehow already put together Patriot Act that in effect ceded the power of Congress into the executive branch, transferring it into a unitary executive operating under a dictatorial framework, a perpetual state of emergency. Our fear is rooted in that narrative. And given that narrative, America has changed so that, in the words of Dick Cheney, we work the dark side now. And from this moral base of working the dark side, torture makes sense, as does indiscriminate drone attacks and an economy rooted in permanent war, surveillance of citizens, punishment of whistleblowers, and oppression of investigative journalists. If reality is defined as everyone is out to get us, the current moral order of permanent war is plausible, and we the people should just trust Big Daddy to save us. And of course, this moral view is the moral view of empire, not a democratic republic of law rooted in the decision-making capacity of its citizens and a system of checks and balances that disperses power into several different spheres of influence. For Christians, our moral base, our imagination, is rooted in the story that all of us are creatures of a creator, and we have inherent rights to dignity and integrity. As Christians, we see reality from the perspective of the one who is tortured, the one who is a threat to empire. Our ethical base compels us to seek to question the narratives that create the conditions where some are scapegoated to make the rest of us free. And so the issue of torture, particularly because it was a top-down driven imperative, that is, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, their lawyers, Justice Department, the top brass of military and intelligence community, knew of it, approved of it, causes us to ask a basic pastoral, systematic question about our leaders. Are they psychopaths? And Obama's shift to terror through drone attacks and bulking up special forces and continual use of private militias lend credence to our Christian suspicions that the system itself is becoming destructive of life, demonic, working the dark side, taking the gloves off. In such a context, the moral voice of the church really has only one word to say to the state, and that word is repent. And the church's moral voice to the citizenry is to come out of empire, resist and rebel against further imperial hunger and the addiction to power and dominance that such hunger creates. Take the side of the crucified, not the crucifiers. Take the side of those who are practicing reconciliation, not the side of those who are prolonging destruction. And so, to be clear at how impractical asking the state is to repent, I just want to lift up 10 quick actions. They're not quick actions, but 10 actions of what I mean by what happens when the state repents. And the first is to close Guantanamo, but then to give the land back to Cuba as an act of penance. The second is to begin immediately to cut the military budget in half, by 50%, perhaps over the next decade, maybe two decades, and commit to shutting down of our global military bases by the same percentage. The third is to ban private militias. The fourth, which you might not think is related, but I do, is to end extended solitary confinement in domestic prisons as a prelude to a complete overhaul of our domestic penal system. And the fifth is to dismantle homeland security and sever the link between local policing and military armament. The sixth is to reopen an investigation of the 9/11 military intelligence failures. Why has no one been held accountable? Why were those in responsibility promoted, and in some cases, even given great honors like the Medal of Freedom? The seventh, again, you might think a stretch, but I think hand in glove, is to dismantle the Federal Reserve Bank and restore the national purse to the Congress. The eighth is to prosecute the leaders who have broken U.S. and international law codes, and to prosecute the leaders who have, and to free the whistleblowers from prison. And finally, I think where I am in, where the panel would probably be in agreement with me, is to declassify and publish the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's 6,000-page report on torture. None of this is going to happen, maybe the last. To come out of empire is to do the work of penance. To stay within empire is to continue pretending that the system isn't as bad as it actually has become. A religious voice against torture is usually a very respectable and therefore predictable voice. But what is needed today is a voice that goes deeper, insisting that the nation is on a path of spiritual and institutional death, a voice that teaches the nation how to resist and rebel against empire.
So I get to follow that, huh? Thanks very much, all of you, for being here, to Rob and Dick for having us and for organizing the event. The Constitution Project is a small nonprofit in Washington, D.C. We recruit sort of experts and practitioners from across the political spectrum to reach consensus recommendations on how best to protect constitutional rights and civil liberties in a variety of different contexts. A lot of the work that I do is in the national security context around counterterrorism policies and practices. Those experts are organized in a variety of different ways. Our task force on detainee treatment is one of them. We have committees that address specific issues that are standing and ongoing. The task force was a sort of time-mandated group, but as you can see by General Irvine's presence here, the members have continued to work on this issue, which I think is a testament to their incredible dedication. The task force was composed of 11 members, the two co-chairs, General Irvine already mentioned, Ambassador Jones and Congressman Hutchinson. The other members reflected, again, a diversity of political views and expertise in law, the military, diplomacy, the highest levels of the executive branch and Congress, medicine, ethics. It really was an expert group across the board in the various subject matter that the task force investigated. They spent 2 years doing their work, led by a talented staff. Nick Lewis, a former New York Times reporter, led that staff. Investigations occurred in the U.S., Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo, Eastern Europe, Western Europe. In addition to scouring the public record, task force members and staff did interviews with over 100 people, including former Guantanamo detainees, former interrogators, policymakers, and a host of others. The temporal mandate of the report wasn't just post 9/11. It started with the late Clinton years and ran through the early Obama years, which I think, in addition to its bipartisan makeup, was an important factor in the way it's been received to date. Again, as General Irvine mentioned, the task force had no subpoena power or access to classified information, and yet I think it's fair to say did produce the most comprehensive narrative of what's occurred during that time period to date. The impetus for putting the task force together, as Rob mentioned at the outset, was the Obama administration's decision to quote-unquote look forward rather than engage in a thorough and honest and comprehensive discussion about what had been done, particularly in the aftermath of 9/11. I think some of that was clearly rooted in political calculus, fears about being seen as engaging in a witch hunt with respect to the past prior administration. But I think some of it is a reflection of the president's honest belief that he's done or taken all the steps necessary to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. And as we heard from Congressman McDermott, his amendment to enshrine the executive order into law is a perfect example, I think, of why it's clear that isn't the case. The executive order got the CIA out of the detention business and effectively formally shut down the enhanced interrogation program. But an executive order doesn't do what a statute does. It can be overturned at the stroke of a pen by a new president. And I think in that regard, important to remember that then-candidate for President Romney's national security advisors wrote a memo recommending that he do exactly that on his first day in office. There are a number of reforms that I think need to be considered to our institutions, to our laws, if we're serious about prevention going forward. The task force has recommended a number of them, closing loopholes and statutes that smart lawyers sort of seized on and exploited to lawyer acrobatically around legal prohibitions, more transparency about what went on, particularly in the post 9/11 context, starting with release of the Senate Intelligence Committee's 6,300-page report on the CIA detention program, prohibiting reliance on medical providers' opinion that an interrogation technique is safe as a basis for finding it legal, and a number of others. But we won't know the full scope of what's necessary until we know the full scope of what happened. And it's my view that we're not going to see meaningful reform or movement towards that, at least not anything that requires Congress or this administration to be proactive without a shift in public opinion on torture. And I think that shift is unlikely to happen in the absence of a more fulsome truth. Right now, popular culture drives much of the torture debate. Television shows like 24, movies like Zero Dark Thirty, that coupled with what's in the public space from those who were involved in the, quote-unquote, enhanced interrogation program, like former CIA General Counsel John Rizzo and Jose Rodriguez. And that means the debate is had on terms that regularly end up in a discussion over the relative merits of a ticking time bomb hypothetical. That debate's not going to get us very far. And I think in order to have that honest and thorough national conversation, we need more information than we have. Our task force was an attempt to kickstart it, but getting the Senate Intelligence Committee report out is an important next step.
You've been listening to talks given at the Seattle event exposing the truth of U.S. torture. This past April, The Washington Post cited unnamed sources saying the Senate Intelligence Report on the CIA's detention and interrogation program concludes that the CIA, quote, misled the government and the public about the torture program. According to the leak, the CIA downplayed the severity of its interrogation methods, overstated the significance of some prisoners, and took credit for information that detainees had actually surrendered under legal, non-coercive questioning. The Senate report is currently in the process of being declassified. To listen again to this talk or pass it along to a friend, navigate over to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. The web version posts late Friday morning. You'll find helpful links to additional information on our site. While you're there, please let us know what upcoming talks you'd like us to feature. For Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Just a few seconds before 10, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, I'm Bill O'Grady. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Goodwill, a recycler, helping keep reusable goods out of landfills by offering those items in the stores to fund job training programs for individuals with barriers to employment. Goodwill, because jobs change lives. Lows lower to mid-50s tonight, rain likely. Highs Friday, mid to upper 60s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers in the morning.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.